This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, July 26, 2013. I'm Caleb Brown. George Washington was the easy choice to lead the Continental Army, and after the war, he was the easy choice to become our first president. Rob McDonald is an associate professor of history at the United States Military Academy and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. We talked about our first president and his role at the founding at Cato University in 2012.
George Washington is historically remembered as our greatest president. But he's our greatest president, according to historians, at least in my estimation, for not clinging to power, to understanding that his role as president was limited. But of course, he was also the leader of our Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. What was his role in getting that revolution going? What was his role before that?
Well, I think one of the reasons Washington was selected as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army by the civilian legislators of the Continental Congress is that he was one of them. You know, he spent the bulk of his life as a plantation owner, but also as a member of Virginia's House of Burgesses, Virginia's legislature. As a very young man, he was a member of Virginia's militia. He was a 23-year-old colonel. Very high rank for a 23-year-old who served in the opening scenes of the French and Indian War. So when Washington was selected to lead the army in 1775, he was one of the very few people who had significant leadership experience, military leadership experience, but also a relative degree of youth and vigor that would be necessary during the course of the War for Independence from Great Britain.
He seemed to be somebody who was driven largely by a sense of duty. Mm-hmm. And that is not to take anything away from the fact that he was, in many respects, quite pessimistic about the likelihood of success for the Continental Army. So in some ways, he was like, well, this is a duty I will take on, but you know, the costs could be quite high.
Yeah, he certainly was aware of all the challenges that the Continental Army faced. This is a war against the world's greatest superpower. I mean, Great Britain had you know, proven its excellence during the French and Indian War, you know, which had been fought here in America beginning in 1754. And Washington was there. Washington had fought with the British. And yet he knew from his experience that the British could make mistakes as well. And I think he knew that time was on the side of Americans. We were here in America. We were defending our own turf. We were defending our own hearths, our own homes. The British, they had to retain a degree of political will in order to stay here. And as the war raged on, as Britain's gains proved to be fleeting, they would occupy an American city, but when they left, they would lose control of it. As Britain saw that it was failing to win hearts and minds in America, I think Washington understood that our goal was not so much to defeat the British, but to allow the British to withdraw and give up.
Okay, I hear a lot of modern parallels to that. I mean, essentially, the British were fighting an insurgency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's good truth to that. Washington, of course, wanted very much to have the Continental Army shaped as a modern European-style professional military force. Indeed, it got more professional as the War for Independence progressed. But he wasn't going to meet the British on the battlefield on British terms. He was very selective about when he fought. He wanted to fight at places. He wanted to fight at times where the American army had a very strong chance of winning. And the last thing he wanted to do was to see his army captured. It was keeping the army alive, keeping the revolution alive, exhausting the British, tiring the British out. And frankly, the longer the British stayed in America, the more the British alienated the civilian population of America.
Counterinsurgency 101 then for the British was in no way successful.
It really wasn't. I mean, the British were very heavy-handed with the civilian population. An example is in 1777, the British are trying to subdue the Hudson River region, and General John Burgoyne apparently contracts with local Native American tribes and is willing to pay them to produce the scalps of American patriots who live along the Hudson River. And there's a young woman, a loyalist, who's engaged to a young British officer, a woman named Jane McCrae. And she is famous for her beauty and her long flowing red hair. The story goes that a Native American was pulling scalps out of a bag, and Jane McCrae's fiance was counting out the money to pay him for you know this horrible crime against civilians. And he looked in utter horror as the Native American reached into the bag and pulled out the long, flowing, red, unmistakable locks of his now dead fiance, now murdered fiance, Jane McCrae. I mean, that was a story that we not only know today, it was a story that people knew back then. And George Washington made the most of it. He was talking about it for years. So the British certainly did a bad job managing their message and cultivating good relations with the American people.
Following the war, what was a defining characteristic of Washington's contribution to the Constitutional Convention? He does not have a lot of writings under his belt, but of course Alexander Hamilton was one of his trusted aides during the war, mm-hmm. and it seemed that George Washington chose people very carefully to surround himself with sort of proxies for his own thinking, people he trusted, people he knew that had the right animating principles. What was his role in the convention?
Well, Washington was urged not only by Hamilton, but also maybe most importantly by James Madison, you know, another figure who was very important in his life at this time, to preside over the Constitutional Convention. One of the problems of this project to ratify this new Constitution was the question of its legitimacy. We already had a constitution. We had the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation had a process by which the articles could be amended and changed, and we weren't following those procedures. So people questioned the legitimacy of the idea of coming up with a new constitution, and yet there was no other figure in America who could bestow greater legitimacy upon this project, upon this enterprise, than George Washington. So when he agreed to serve as president of the Constitutional Convention, to sit in the chair and lead the discussion about how this new framing document should be shaped, he was putting at risk his most prized possession, his reputation. But he was also giving a reputation, a positive reputation and a sense of legitimacy to the Constitution that emerged from those proceedings.
As the Constitution was emerging, was it clear to other participants at the convention that George Washington is the guy to get this thing started in terms of our first president?
Yeah, by all accounts. I mean, during the course of the imperial crisis leading up to the revolution, during the revolution, a lot of people were very skeptical of executive leadership. And the knowledge that George Washington would be our first president meant that he, in many respects, the office was shaped for him. He also, of course, shaped the office. You know, Washington established a number of precedents, most famous, maybe most important, being stepping down after two terms. There was no constitutional prohibition against the perpetual reelectability of the president at the time. Washington was unanimously elected twice. Certainly, he could have been reelected a third time, but he had a sense that it was important for this office to rotate. It was important not to serve in it for forever. And if you think about what example he would have set had he agreed to stand and serve for a third term, he would have died in office. I mean, he died in December 1799, just a little bit more than 2 years after his third term would have began.
We know that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and pretty much every president since George Washington has felt considerable constraints on their powers as president and have been bothered by those constraints. Do we have evidence that George Washington himself was bothered by the constraints of the office that, as you say, was carved out for him?
I don't know if I'd say that he was bothered by them. He was certainly alert to them, and he certainly sought advice from people about what those constraints were, and not just constitutional ones, not just formal ones, but also informal ones. For example, I mean, Washington very much wanted to be the president of all the people. He very much wanted to be seen as an impartial figure. And when people invited him to their houses for dinner in Philadelphia when he was president, he really didn't know what to do. He would write letters to people like Thomas Jefferson asking for advice. Should I go? If I don't go, will it be seen as rude and insulting? If I do go, will I be seen as bestowing upon them some sort of special favor or special approval? So Washington was very scrupulous, very careful, very thoughtful about how his actions would be interpreted and what sort of precedents he was setting for the future.
Rob McDonald is an associate professor of history at the United States Military Academy and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He'll be speaking at Cato University in Washington, D.C. next week. You can learn more at cato.org.